of immigrants, but Rubalcava and Rodriguez, who are both Latino, see no problem with white boy tacos being a part of that food squad.
Better than mom, grandma's?
Better than, well...
Uh-oh!
No comments.
Yeah, we're getting in trouble if I say yes.
Through his humble food stand, White Boy Tacos owner Ben McMillan has found a way to serve both foodies who hunger for something new and the homeless who are simply hungry. Lana Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
And that does it for this week's program. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.
You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Listen to Free Speech Radio News every Friday at 5 p.m. on WEFT Community Radio, followed by Smile Politely Radio coming up next. Stay with us after that for R&B and Hip Hop at 6 p.m., followed by Blues Live at 8 and The Bachelor Pad at 10 p.m. And I do want to just briefly mention that next weekend will be the 8th Annual Folk and Roots Festival in downtown Urbana. So you might want to find out more about that by going online at folkandroots.org. And now for this week's edition of Smile Politely Radio.
You are listening to Smile Politely Radio. SmilePolitely.com is the place to go for all things local. Arts, culture, food and drink, music, opinion, tech, and more. I'm Rebecca, and I'm joined this week by Catherine Scott Nelson. Hi, Scott.
Hi, nice to meet you. Thank you.
And Scott is going to read a piece of writing that was presented at the Reading Room at the Accord. The Reading Room is, of course, a series of presentations by literary artists that takes place every month. And to get us started, could you introduce yourself?
I'm about to graduate from UIUC with an MFA in creative writing. Piece I'm going to read for you today is an excerpt from a larger nonfiction piece. We're not sure yet if it's a book. Yeah, so this is called Dinner in a Fight. I got my testosterone prescription from Howard Brown Health Center in Chicago, which was, at the time, one of only a few clinics in the country that would prescribe hormones to a trans person whose identity was something other than man or woman. Before they handed it over to me, I had to sit down with a staff psychiatrist to provide informed consent, and possibly to make sure I waived my right to sue if I was unhappy with the results. They warned me that, quote, testosterone causes permanent and irreversible changes. Most of my trans friends have been fired from one job or another, usually shortly after this point, and I work as a bartender and server for a high-end catering company that mandates women wear makeup and men cut their long hair and remove any jewelry other than watches and wedding rings. I steeled myself to be once again unemployed and considering Social Security disability for depression. But if anything, I become more invisible at work, growing to fit the shape of the suit jacket, no longer stumbling or pulling muscles as I swing 50 pounds of ice in each hand or run up the stairs with another case of Heineken. Random men stop hitting on me by trying to do my job for me. No one notices my voice gradually deepening. And even when catfish whiskers start sprouting from my jawline, no one says anything, lest they violate a cardinal rule of polite discourse. Never, ever point out a woman's facial hair. In this context, I'm a girl, which should make me too uncomfortable to function. But everything in this context is a stand-in for something else. Like the green barrel on top of a plastic milk crate draped with stiff white linen to look like a column of ice. The food, portioned out on an assembly line, an imitation of banquet opulence. The artificially heated plates meant to suggest fresh cooking, rather than a wall of Sterno cans reheating meals that were thrown together at 5 a.m. and wheeled onto trucks in a windy parking lot on the south side. Girl comes off at me at night with the polyester linen imitation tuxedo. It washes off with the eyeshadow and mascara that I've learned nets me more tips. Besides, I'm the only person marked female on the bar crew, and believe me, I notice the surprise in some men's voices when I am good at my job. I imagine, I play a butler for a couple of hours. I can hold up for lady bartenders, too. The staff psychiatrist also asked me, how do you plan to handle coming out and transitioning at work? Like name changes, bathroom use, have you disclosed to HR yet? I picture the identity this question assumes. Straightforward, fixed, culturally intelligible, no difficulty translating across languages or contexts. Whereas most days I have trouble explaining myself to myself. I picture the workplace this question assumes. A place with bathrooms we are allowed to use. A place with gender-differentiated clothing. A place with an HR department. And a place where beef is called disputes and moderated by said HR department. An environment where almost everyone is white and grew up in the suburbs, like me, and where everyone went to college, where hopefully a gender and women's studies or intro composition class taught them about trans people and about the importance of being nice to us. A workplace where only English is spoken, and where everyone understands terms like I identify as or gender confirmation therapy. In short, a not at all diverse workplace whose upper management puts on a show of valuing diversity. The kind of company it's assumed I will return to one day after I've had my fun slumming with the proles. After I explained this, more politely, of course, the staff psychiatrist wrote down, not planning to disclose, on my file. That's a funny thing, disclosure. It's not always the same as telling. A few months back, I had an interview for a job as a financial copy editor. When I arrived in my nice suit, with a face full of makeup, the person from HR bit her lip and looked me up and down. What was supposed to be a 2-hour interview with testing was over in 5 minutes. To think of it now, I felt like a trespasser on someone else's private property, a wedding bartender in an English major suit. A few months after that, in the dead of winter, I was doing a corporate gig, food and beverage support for a group of accountants locked in a conference room with a year-end audit. I pour them milk and serve cookies, and for $5 tips, I make to-go cups of coffee with 2 shots of bourbon in them. By the time they finish, at around 3 a.m, enormous piles of paper cover every surface of the conference room. I can hear the Occupy Wall Street protests wrapping up 2 blocks away. I go to sign out, and the office manager tells me I need to stay and clean the office and enunciates every syllable very clearly, so I get it, okay? So here I am, making a third of my old pay to get on my hands and knees and swipe up papers, P&L sheets, and cash positions. The woman who set me on this job doesn't know that I used to be the treasury accounting clerk at a multinational investment bank. She doesn't know that I know how to read these papers I am stuffing in the big black garbage bag. She doesn't know that I could string them together and find missing or misallocated funds and cash that's getting skimmed off and siphoned elsewhere. And I could do all these things, but I don't care anymore. It is stupid o'clock, and I don't care about proving myself a good white-collar employee, and I don't care about winning this stranger's approval just because she might be able to put in a good word for me at HR, and all I want to do is go home and take off my shoes and wash my face and drink 2 shots of whiskey and be somewhere else. Before long, it's wedding season again. We work outside on days when it's 95 degrees by 10 in the morning, when even the trees seem to be melting in the languid heat, when the sun is a bleached haze, and our white undershirts are stained and wet by noon, our socks sweated stiff when we take them off at night. The ice melts inside the barrels where it's stacked 6 bags deep, and forms a solid brick that you have to break 5 or 6 times by throwing the bag against the pavement. Sometimes I sweat so much that all my makeup is gone by start time. I get home at 3, 4, 5 in the morning. I fall asleep in sweaty sheets, in a room so small and hot that my floorboards seem to steam and warp, with the sound of the L from half a block away bleeding through the open windows and still air, and then in 5 hours I get up again. By the end of wedding season, my hands are so completely destroyed that I have trouble brushing my teeth or turning a doorknob, my nails soft and ragged and prone to ripping across the quick, tiny paper cuts and hangnails where the lime juice bites in, skin so dry and tight across bones it feels like I'm wearing gloves a size too small. One night, in desperation, I coat my hands with an entire tube of Neosporin, put on latex gloves, and leave them on overnight like a burn victim. On one particularly hot crotch swamp of a day, we are working a fundraising dinner at Ravinia, an outdoor classical music venue in the northern suburbs. Setup is your typical thing. Three different managers tell you three different things, making you redo and redo the tables and place settings, and then the client wants everything reversed 45 minutes before start time. In the chaos, my bag disappears from the makeshift outdoor kitchen, with my cell phone and house keys inside. I'm put on a two-man bar with LaRoyce, a middle-aged stage actor. While we're waiting for the guests to arrive, LaRoyce bows his head, folds his hands, and asks the Lord for $25. "Does that work?" I ask. "Every time," he says. $25 seems like such a trifling thing to bother God for. I ask him, "So why not pray for a just economy?" He chuckles at me and shakes his head, like I've just asked him the dumbest question in the world. Like, why don't you scoop ice with a glass? He instructs me, "Sometimes, with the Lord, you gotta be a little more specific." He offers to pray that I will find my missing bag with my cell phone and keys inside. I figure it can't hurt, so I bow my head and pray along. I know he's not going to get the 25 bucks, just like I know I'll be calling a 24-hour locksmith from my corner bar's phone in a couple of hours. Here, the crowd is so cheap, grabby, demanding, and mean that many coworkers specifically refuse to work at the venue. The only people here tonight are the ones who really need the $30 in wages we'll net after transportation and meals. If I'm lucky, I'll leave with enough money for a PBR and an okay tip while I'm waiting for the locksmith. LaRoyce makes $5 in singles throughout the shift without wavering in his faith. 5 minutes before his cut, a guest shakes his hand, says, "Thank you for everything tonight, sir," and hands him a 20. He waves goodnight to me as he heads toward the bus back to the city. I stay until the tent is knocked down and packed up at 2 a.m, which is when I find my bag leaning against a skinny tree. My house keys and my cell phone are in the front pocket. Around this time, the baby novel I'd been fooling with for 10 years was picked up by a basement publisher and shortlisted for the Lambda Literary Awards. I fly to New York to attend the awards ceremony with an arsenal of lorazepam. Throughout the awards ceremony, I put my head between my knees. Do I hear a subtle booing at someone named Catherine being considered for a debut gay fiction award? I'm going to throw up. I'm going to pass out. I'm going to throw up and then pass out. If they call my name, I won't be able to stand up. Why didn't I prepare a speech? What was I thinking? I'm not called. I collapse in the seat with disappointment and relief. The rest of the evening passes by in a blur. I fly home with a suitcase of free books. I'm back at work on Thursday, unrolling the same black plastic floor mat, mixing the same vile orange juice concentrate, saying the same platitudes to the guests. In the height of the summer, I get home at 2 or 3 a.m. after a 15-hour shift, 3 or 4 days in a row, and if I don't have a clean shirt for tomorrow, I throw them in the basement washing machine and wait for them to finish. I iron the one-ply white shirts into tight creases and hang them up to dry overnight. One of the free books I bring home is a themed anthology. Famous queer authors write letters of support to their struggling younger selves. I read most of it in the laundry room while waiting for the spin cycle to finish. It seems like every third writer assures their younger selves that they won't be a waitress or barista or bartender forever. It does comfort me to think that one day all this will matter to somebody else. The boring days. Bearing the humiliation of getting yelled at for forgetting to bring the customers clean silverware between courses, and the double humiliation of realizing that I am a person to whom this matters. The couple of scattered hours every week where I sit down with my notebook and try to put sentences together. But what does it mean that I can only prove my worth by escaping? As I peel my white work shirts off the walls of the washing machine, I tell myself, it is okay if you become a grizzled old catering lifer, muttering to yourself as guests deign to try the coconut chicken skewers you're carrying on an imitation silver platter. You are not worth less as a person if you don't become a great writer, if you toil in obscurity with no payoff ever, even posthumously. And maybe if I say it enough, I can make myself believe it. LaRoyce and I are walking underneath the freeway overpass after a shift at the Field Museum. After a couple of near misses returning his ice scoop, I've mailed it to him, which makes us work friends now. Ice scoops are hard to find, and the drop-forged aluminum kind that won't slice your palm open on a busy night are even rarer. A mouse skitters across the sidewalk, hiding from the rising autumn wind. "What train do you take?" LaRoyce asks me. "Red Line," I say, referring to the long vertical slash that should link the two Chicagos, but doesn't. I hate the red line, he says. I hate it so much I'll walk the 4 extra blocks and take the blue line just so I don't have to transfer. We bond over the late night nonsense. The drunken, violent Cubs fans who punch each other out and puke all over the floor and threaten strangers for looking at their girlfriends, and who never get so much as a knock-it-off fellas from cops or security. He says, you have to be prepared to get ignorant with somebody on the red line. And then he says, I don't tell many people this, but I was homeless for about 11 months, in 2010 and 2011. I never know what to say when people reveal things like this. I stand and nod, a silent witness. He says, I was working full-time while this was going on, pulling double shifts at the Congress Plaza Hotel. Nobody at work knew. I kept all my stuff in my locker. I'd wash up in the men's room and then go to work. I begin to wonder, is this something I should be filing away for my own future reference? How many floors will I fall through? He admits, I stole a knife from the kitchen. And all night, I'd ride the red line from one end of the line to the other, with one eye open, one eye closed, and one hand on my knife. He shivers and pulls his tux jacket close. I hate the damn red line. Keep your clothes in your locker at work. Wash up in whatever bathroom is letting you through the door at the time. Get a knife from the kitchen. Ride the red line from one end to the other. Be prepared to get ignorant. I try to offer something, so I say, it's got to be scary being out of doors like that. Someone gets mean and you'd be the first person they find. I shouldn't have said that. He nods and whispers, yeah, and something in his eyes changes. The light in them narrows, shrinks, and runs to hide. Then he blinks and shakes his head, and he's back. I consider telling him about the spike of testosterone I'm hiding under my skin, about my other name. If he's told me a hard secret, I should tell him one in return. But I don't say anything. This was supposed to be a throwaway job, a paycheck stopping the gap. I wasn't prepared for how it would uproot all of my assumptions about the fairness of life and the workings of the world, and especially the inner lives of others. We separate a block later, where I climb the steps to the red line and he turns west to the Dearborn Street subway. I only prayed at work one more time, when I was about to be late for a double shift. I'd missed the train and had to drive, and I was trying to find a parking space in Wrigleyville at around 3 p.m. on a day with a Cubs game. Driving along the walls of cars lining every block, I grew more and more frantic and finally blurted out, God, please, I need a parking space. I need these hours. Help me not get cut tonight. As I passed the venue, up ahead, against all odds, a set of brake lights flashed. I can respect asking for only what you need to get from point A to point B. After all, it's give us this day our daily bread, right? But the instant I parked the car, I knew I'd been an idiot. I opened up a line of communication with God, and I asked for a parking space. If I had the opportunity to do it again, I'd say, side with us. Stand with the people who fight, dream, love, and create. Make us believe that our lives are worthwhile and our struggles are important, even on the days when we are homeless, abused, ignored. May words, blows, laws, knives, and bullets all fall at our feet. Thanks.
For the rest of the program, we'll hear poems read by Janice Harrington. Janice also read recently at the Reading Room at the Accord. Janice, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
To get us started, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Janice Harrington. I'm a poet and a children's writer, and I currently work at the University of Illinois in the English Department, creative writing.
Wonderful. And before we hear a few of your poems, can you introduce us to these poems? What should we listen for? What kinds of things do you think about as you're writing, and where does your writing emerge from?
Basically, memory, a lot of times. I think that's where I do my data mining, looking at history or looking at relationships. I'm also a poet of place. But the two poems I'd like to read today are odd bedfellows. The first one I think will serve as an introduction to myself. It's called Self-Portrait with a Catfish. And the second one actually comes from my latest book. I have a new one coming out this fall, but my latest book, which is Hands of Strangers, and it's set in a nursing home. And it's a poem that I think shows the caretaking and the hard work and the difficult relationships in a nursing home.
Wonderful.
Self-portrait with catfish. Stately is the catfish in its electric suit, silt filter, river drinker, bottom squatter in its sleeve of mud, tail fanned into a winning hand of poker, and lips closed like the curtains of a confessional. This is the fish that hears the fisherman's heel at 100 yards, the fish that listens unseen beneath mirrored waters in the mud dark, the fish of bayou and impoundment, of lake and slough and bottom. Chucklehead, mudfish, fiddler, pollywog, buttercat, greaser. Legend says that a catfish holds up the world. I believe it. I believe the stars are glimmering fry, the Milky Way, the milt of 10,000 catfish, the moon, a dough ball closed in a bullhead's mouth, and the folds of space as smooth as a catfish that slips the hook and swims away. Yes, I believe it. Tomorrow, let us awaken as catfish. Tomorrow, let us touch all that we know with our tongue skins. Magnolia petals taste of cardamom, and lonely is the salt-blooded tinge after a tooth is pulled. What is the sound of 10,000 catfish swimming in a levee pool pond? How long would it take 13 catfish to circumnavigate the earth? A catfish dies knowing wake and wave and wefts of light, knowing electric shimmer, the tremor of tectonic plates, and the odor of a body adrift in the waters of Lake Pontchartrain. A catfish dies knowing that longing is barbed, knowing the feeble shelters we make beneath drift and wreckage, and how easily everything settles, drawn downward by insatiate mud, to be swallowed by catfish and made into flesh that will rise again slowly. The second poem is from my book, The Hands of Strangers. And it goes in a different direction, and it's called Pietà. She stoops, this should have retired aide, in her polished and repolished shoes and white uniform, lifting this fetal shape, the body of a wordless man who only groans, his eyes startled into clear ice, his blue milk skin, blue veined and blue bruised, eases against her chest. His brow leans into her shoulder. His lips press her uniform's rough pleats and leave damp wings traced in spittle above her breast. Though she does not notice, and straining bears the weight as the years have taught, her knees bent, back levered into straightness, breathing in, breathing out, muscles tight. She lowers him as you would lower an overfilled basin, settling its shallow wash gently, leaving even the refracted light undisturbed.
Thank you. chance.